Welcome to Unshackled Leadership, a lantern for Black women. This program is produced to help women of color in leadership move from their zone of excellence to their zone of genius by eliminating any false upper limits caused by race, gender, culture, or their own inner critic. This program is dedicated to the legacy of Harriet Tubman, who held a lantern in the dark for all of us. I'm your host, ICF-certified executive leadership coach, Joya Jefferson Nuri. Welcome back to Unshackled Leadership, a lantern for Black women. I am so glad you have returned. We are about to close out 2 years on the air as a podcast, and we have focused on the lives of women of color in the United States. We suffer the slings and arrows of misogyny, racism, our inner critic, and all of that. But let's broaden this. Women of color all over the world who speak a wide variety of languages suffer the same things. They suffer political oppression and violence, and I wanted you to meet one. I want this show to be more internationally focused so that we can understand as women of color, we are one. We are one in what goes on in our lives, but some of us have situations that are much worse. In November of 2023, I was invited by the Open Society Foundation to host a workshop on the inner critic for 50 women of color from around the world who came to San Francisco to be part of a weekend of understanding and strengthening their role as political leaders in their countries. It was an honor to be there. It was exhilarating. I had tears and laughter and applause. And I want you to meet one of the participants. She is Suying Barahona, and she is from Nicaragua. She was a political leader there and stood her ground. She was the president of UNAMOS, which is a political party, a progressive political party in Nicaragua. And because of her activities against a dictatorship, she was arrested and confined illegally twice. The most recent time, she was held in solitary confinement for 606 days. She was arrested in front of her three-year-old child. I want you to meet her, hear her story, and hear the story of resiliency. Suyin, welcome to Unshackled Leadership.
Oh, thank you so much, Joya. It's just an honor to be here with you. And I want to echo what you just mentioned, how inspiring it was to be in the company of so many incredible young women leaders back in November, and to be in your company and also learn from your wisdom. I think you gave us just such amazing advice in that convening about our inner critic, about, you know, really looking at our maximum potential. And it's just an honor. It's just an honor to be also here with you and to be in your company and to continue to learn with you.
You know, I thank you for that, but it was really my honor. One of the most exhilarating things that has ever happened to me was when you gave your keynote, you used the mantra I left with everybody. I am enough. I have enough. I do enough. And when you closed your keynote by saying, let's remember what Joya taught us. I am enough. I have enough. I do enough. And to watch the women in the room applaud and stand chanting, I am enough. I have enough. I do enough, brought tears to my eyes. And I actually thought to myself, Joya, be careful about what you say to people. They take it in. they're actually listening to what you're saying.
That's why I said, I mean, you really did impact us so much. I feel like so many of us who are in activism, in all kinds of activism, no, social activism, political activism, it's balance is one of the things that is really hard. And also, sometimes feeling, no, that we don't do enough, that there's, because there's so much to be done and we want to change, you know, the world, and we want to change and make life better for others. And so it's hard. It's hard to sometimes take care of ourselves and to feel that we are doing what we can, and to even see sometimes, you know, the impact of our activism or our contribution. So I feel like it really resonated what you taught us, what we talked about. And yeah, so it was for me actually also a moment of reflection after this, you know, this experience of being in jail, like you mentioned. You know, it's been actually just over a little bit over a year so that I was released. And as you and maybe just go back and say that I am from Nicaragua, and that's a very important part of my identity, which is a small country in Central America that unfortunately has consolidated a totalitarian state. So in these last almost two decades, I've been involved in human rights work and the struggle for democracy and justice in my country with many, many other women. And I'm also a feminist. That's part of my identity. I'm a mom too. I'm a mom of now a 7-year-old boy. And part of, as part of my identity as a, you know, as a feminist, I'm part of a broader women's movement, no, that has been really struggling also to advance agendas for in favor of women and equity.
Tell us what it felt like to be in that dictatorship. What were you protesting? What were you fighting against?
Yeah. We were demanding basic minimum rights, the right to speak, to dissent. We were demanding free and fair elections. 2021, there was going to be elections in Nicaragua in December, 6 months before I was incarcerated. And not only I was incarcerated. We were demanding justice. In 2018, there was a huge social uprisings in Nicaragua demanding change and changes in government. And unfortunately, the government responded by killing those most of them young people actually that took on to the streets in demand of democracy in Nicaragua. But we were demanding to be able to protest in the street, Joya. Unfortunately, the situation in Nicaragua is so critical that you cannot like post something in your social network without being, you know, against the government, without going to jail. You cannot go to the street to be able to and hold a flag, a Nicaraguan flag, without going to jail. You cannot protest.
You can't hold the flag without going to jail?
No, you cannot. There are people who unfortunately were in jail for a year and a half, because they went to a street and held on a corner of their of a street a Nicaraguan flag, and kind of that's a now it's become the sign of, you know, of rebellion to hold your own flag. People now cannot, there's also religious persecution against the Catholic Church, and you can't, for example, go to certain religious activities in the streets. They've been banned. There is no media, no independent media left open in the country. So it's unfortunately become a absolutely totalitarian state where you have the dictator, which is Daniel Ortega, and his wife, who is the vice president, who has taken over, and they have control over all the branches of government, and they are have been supported by the police and the military. No, so a totalitarian state where all of our rights have basic rights have been denied, and so very, very basic rights. That's what we were all demanding. And that's how, you know, I ended up being incarcerated with political leaders, some of the candidates that wanted to run for the presidency, peasant farmers, journalists, human rights activists, feminist activists, students. And that's been the case for the last almost 6-7 years, a wave of brutal government repression.
UNEMOS, your organization that you led, tell me the work you were doing.
Yes. So UNEMOS is a progressive opposition political party, a movement, really. And it was, and part of what it promotes is democracy, progress, opportunity, solidarity, and justice. Those are kind of their pillars. And we were also part of the many other groups demanding, a change in the country. And very specifically that year, we were demanding the possibility that there be free and fair elections so that the people of Nicaragua, as so many people around the world, have the right, to decide on who will govern them. And so that's what we were promoting, no? And it had been many, many years in which that was kind of our struggle, and supporting other social movements, the women's movement, which is a very, very belligerent movement. And I had become part of the party, really convinced Joya that we really needed strong, belligerent, and independent social movements, but that we also needed more women empowered, participating also within formal political spaces in order to further some of the agendas that we wanted to move forward, the gender and racial equality agendas and democracy. And that's why I got involved in politics. I actually come more from I've been more of an activist, no? And I began my political involvement as an environmental activist, and then got more involved, in politics as I saw the closing of the democratic space in the country. And also, as I said, I was very much convened by women too. I saw a group of, powerful women really wanting to change how politics was being done, and to also gain influence and power in this political party. We got together and we planned together, and we were able to get the first woman elected and the youngest woman elected in that party.
And what was she elected to? What seat?
The presidency. Yeah, okay. And at that time, she was the youngest woman president of a political party in all of Central America. So that was really important. We had already a woman president, but this one was the youngest. And then we really planned to see how women could get elected, in positions of power, because we wanted to really contribute to also diminish the barriers that women were facing in these political spaces. And we wanted to transform Nicaragua and really promote gender equality.
I have a question about her being elected to the presidency. What is Ortega's title?
He is the president.
She was elected before Ortega took over.
She was elected before, no, During the period of Ortega. Unfortunately, the dictatorship of Ortega began in 2006. In 2006, he was through fraud was elected, and unfortunately, those there were these series of electoral processes, but that were not free and fair. So that's what's happened in the last 15 years or so. And this young woman was elected to be the president of this political party, of this of UNAMOS, no? So, so I felt like it made sense to me, if we wanted to change Nicaragua, but I feel like if we want to change the world, Joya, we really do need a strong women's movement that's belligerent, that's independent, but also more women in these political positions.
Absolutely. I mean, globally, we need to do that. So you say you were arrested twice.
Yeah.
Tell me about the first arrest.
Yeah, the first arrest was in 2018, in the midst of basically some of the uprising that was happening in Nicaragua and the protest. And we were a group of us, not only from my political party, but just young people, elderly people. We were trying to do a very peaceful protest. And the police, that was the last time I think that any Nicaraguan was able to protest in the streets. And we were not even in the street. We were in near a supermarket, which was like a private property, and the police came and basically took us, and there were around 35 people that we were arrested. And that was a very short period. There was a lot of protest around the fact that we had been arrested. And I was only there like for 36 hours or so. And then I was liberated. But a lot of the harassment continued. So, like, I continued. There was surveillance. There was, I was followed all over. Even if I was with my family or my child, and a lot of the online harassment too, continued to happen throughout that period after I was arrested. At some point, I had to change the house. I had to leave temporarily the country because the harassment was so so harsh, was really difficult. And at that time, my son was like a year and a half. I was still breastfeeding when I was arrested, I remember. And that's when a lot of the harassment and repression began too.
I thought the story of your second arrest was so brutal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So can you tell us about the second arrest and 606 days?
Yeah. So I was, like you mentioned, I was arbitrarily detained on June 13. I knew that they were probably
coming. What year was that?
That was in 2021.
Uh-huh.
In 2021. And I more or less knew that they were coming. And I was in my house because I had done nothing wrong. And I had already agreed that I was not going to leave my house because I had done nothing wrong. And so around 8 pickup trucks with like 10 riot police officers carrying weapons, really, of war. And without any warrant, Joya, because unfortunately that's the reality in Nicaragua. There's no rule of law. And they broke into the neighborhood and surrounded my entire house. I was with my 4-year-old son, and actually he was the one who saw them enter the neighborhood through the security cameras. And it really moves me every time I think about it, because I remember that he ran out and yelled and started yelling, "Mama, Papa, the police are coming, the police are coming." And so in order to prevent kind of the more violence, During that raid, I decided to go out in front of my house and with my hands up and yelled, you know, to them, there's a 4-year-old boy inside the house, please. There's a 4-year-old boy inside the house. And then like within seconds, this group of armed men and women, they grabbed me, they violently pushed my head down, handcuffed me. And I was, the last thing that I was able to see was actually the eyes and the little face of my frightened 4-year-old son watching these armed officers break into the house. And I was trying to see his face and just see what was going to happen to him. And I remember that, you know, one of the police women said it, or an officer said to the police woman, if she raises her head again, you know, crack her head wide open. So that was kind of the last opportunity I had to see my son. And I know then that it lasted about like 6 hours, and I was taken to a jail called in Nicaragua El Chipote, which is known for as a jail of torture, really, and was held like you said in isolation for the whole period. Three other of my feminist colleagues, Ana Margarita Vigil, Tamara Dávila, and Dora María, which are also part of my political party, but also feminists, were also held. And the most, I think one of the most brutal parts were basically that for the first 81 days, I was in a state of forced disappearance, Joya. My family didn't know where I was, how I was. We were not allowed to see them or communicate with them. And I wasn't able to receive any information, although I requested, you know, to see my family, to see a lawyer, which is my right. And I was always denied that. And that imprisonment was really experiencing, yeah, an environment of torture. So I was in isolation. I was in a cell all the time alone. There was an absolute prohibition to socialize with others. The torture included depriving me of sunlight, especially the first year. You know, I was very scarce opportunities to be able to go out of that cell and get some sunlight. I was not allowed for those 606 days to read, to write. I remember I requested a Bible like the first day, the first week, and was denied the possibility of a Bible. And throughout the period also, part of that environment of torture included food restriction. And, I was interrogated even 9 months after having already been sentenced, and I continued to be interrogated. That was also part of that, you know, strategies. And then what was terrible was that we were denied visits from our families. They were very, very scarce. We never knew when or at what time we were going to be able to see them. Our families were also threatened and harassed every time that they visited us. And then I think the most terrible, you know, acts that we, as especially those of us who had minors, was that we were denied the possibility of seeing them, of communicating with them, of even like sending some sort of communication via phone or something. They didn't allow any picture or a drawing or anything. So I spent basically a year and a half, it was like until December 25th of 2022, that I was able to speak in a video call for like 10, 15 minutes with my son and surrounded by officers and taking video cameras. They were taping. And that was the first time that I was able to see my son, like after a year and a half. It was just difficult for him even to recognize me. Of course, you know, the environment of torture included that I had lost a lot of weight. I really had deteriorated physically. So it was a lot of psychological.
So he didn't recognize torture. You.
He had a really hard time. He was in shock. I remember, you know, that time he was really, really in shock because I had changed so much. And actually, after I was released, he continued to, you know, ask so many questions because he just saw me very, very different last year that we were able to reunite. So
how is he now? You've been out over a little over a year now, right?
Yeah, he's good. You know, he's been one of the sources of healing for me. And, you know, when I was in jail, I was really at some point very, very, I was very, very saddened and also concerned about, you know, him thinking that I had been separated because I wanted to, instead of, you know, being forced.
It was Oh my God.
You know, I was really wanting.
So he thought you just left him.
I explained to him that probably Mama was going to be separated for a while, never thinking that it was going to be, you know, 606 days, to be honest, and that his papa was going to take care of him and so on. And so one of my issues of torture was basically also trying to see how I could explain to this little boy, a 4.5-year-old, what was happening, no? So one of the strategies that helped me survive was actually writing a story. I had no pen or paper, but I tried to occupy my mind in trying to make up a story for him to be able to understand what was happening and why we were not together. And so, in one of the visits, I told the story to my brother, and then my brother told whatever he remembered to my sister, and then my sister ended up writing this story for him about this experience, and that really helped me when I was released, you know, for him to have like a way of asking me about this whole experience. And And part of his questions, of course, were around like whether how had I convinced them to, you know, to release me and to talk to him, and then all sorts of questions about where I was and injustices and also this, about this injustice, and for him to really understand that it was something that was beyond kind of my possibilities of being with him, that they had taken me from him, and that there were so many people that were demanding that we were together, that's what allowed us to be together. So that helped me a lot. And really my son was one of the sources of me being able to survive, because once I was there, I you know, the first thing I thought was, I need to come out of this experience with sane first, to be able to be with my son and to be able to take care of him. So he was definitely a source of inspiration and of strength for me throughout this very, very difficult experience. I think that, you know, the worst part was being apart from him, of course, but also, unfortunately, I also saw the death of a dear friend, and he was the vice president of my political party. He died under the custody of the police while in jail, and unfortunately, I was able to see how he deteriorated. We don't know yet until this date what exactly was the cause of death, but that was just terrible, you know, that to realize that you could actually die while you were there.
Yeah. Well, I know your son more than likely is going to be a belligerent activist when he grows older. This experience is going to fuel him in so many ways, and it's very nice that he had, very wonderful, very important that he has a place to express that. Children suffer trauma all over the world, and the parents are not equipped to help them express through it. You did a a good mommy, a great mommy task on that. It was beautiful. So you were released, and I want to hear the story of the release and how you ended up in the United States.
Yeah, so on February 8th that night, suddenly they came to our to the cell and they said that we needed to organize our things and didn't tell us that we were going to be liberated. We actually thought that we might be going to another, we were being transferred to another prison, or that other prisoners were going to come in and join us in the cell. And so I thought, well, finally, I'm going to have someone accompany me in the cell. But in fact, they put us in these buses that were covered, the windows were covered, and we really didn't know where we were going. And suddenly we ended up in the Air Force, basically, in Nicaragua. And there was this huge plane.
An Air Force base? Okay.
Yes. And there was this huge plane. And then we were told basically that we were heading towards the United States.
But you had not seen your son. They just took you from prison.
That's right.
And put you on an airplane.
That's right.
You had no change of clothes.
Nothing. In fact, they told us you cannot take anything, not even like toilet paper. So they put these clothes that we had used for one of the visits. Suddenly what I saw was that people from the United States Department of State were near the airplane. This was like a secret, very secret, secret. It was almost like a hostage negotiation that had happened. The Nicaraguan government reached out to the U.S. government saying that they were willing to liberate or release political prisoners if they were willing to take us to the United States. And so basically that's what happened. We were banished to the United States. And as we were flying on the 9th of February in the morning, we were stripped of our Nicaraguan nationality. And this is really important because these are acts really recognized as crimes against humanity.
So the U.S. State Department assisted in you getting out of Nicaragua.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
And it obviously is very secret because I can't imagine the United States helping people escape torture. I'm sure it happens, but it's not on the news.
Yeah.
And I'm glad it happens. Yeah. Very secret. So you were stripped of your citizenship of Nicaragua. Were you given American citizenship?
No, I am here in the United States with a humanitarian parole. Basically, that's what they could offer because it was such a secret. I'm not even like on a refugee status, none of us. And basically 222 of us, they accepted to release 222 of us political prisoners. And we're on a humanitarian parole. They stripped us of our Nicaraguan nationality. Basically, they erased us from the Nicaraguan civil registry. So nothing remains. People who were retired, for example, their pensions were suspended. Our academic records have been erased. Our bank accounts and properties and assets have been confiscated. It's been terrible, no? The implications of erasing us like from the Nicaraguan civil registry is kind of unimaginable. Also, in terms of the implications for our children, you have already the experiences of parents who want to have their children's birth certificates or passports, and they're denying that in order to be able to reunite with their fathers and mothers.
So your child, and I think your mother are here now in the United States.
Yes. My child and my husband are in the United States. I was one of the very fortunate ones that they had to leave. They had to leave while I was in jail because we were very scared that we would end up in prison, that I would be end up in prison and his father would end up in prison, because that was also part of the threat. And so they had to leave. So when I was released and sent to the US, which is something that I had never imagined in my life that would happen, that I would be banished, really. And I was able to reunite with my son and my husband later that day, on the 9th of February.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. And that was, of course, the most precious and the most incredible moment, I think, that I've experienced in these last years.
This is an incredible story. So as you are not an American citizen, you can't get your papers from Nicaragua. How do you maneuver in this country?
I'm with this humanitarian parole. I was something that was an act of solidarity, you could say, was also that the Spanish government offered the 222 of us the possibility of obtaining the Spanish citizenship. So that's one act of solidarity that we've received. Most people have not necessarily applied to that because they are applying for to become basically a asylum. I am also in that legal process of trying to gain some legal stability here in the country. But it's very difficult. And right now, in order to be able to travel, for example, for work-related issues, then I've been able to get a travel permit, but still in that process of,
Okay, legal. So you're here. So you are now officially a citizen of Spain.
I've initiated, that process, especially to be able to give my son also some sort of citizenship, because the other form of repression that we are experiencing in Nicaragua is that people are being denied the possibility of renewing their passports. So it's a sort of de facto stripping of your nationality. It's not by decree, but then it's like, you're trapped in a country that it's not your own. And then many people also, and family members especially, in my case, are denied the possibility of entering their own country, which is, absurd.
You can never go back to
Nicaragua. They can't. Exactly. My mom, she came in to have a medical procedure, left the country, and then when she wanted to go back, she was denied the possibility of entering her country. This is our only nationality. She has no other nationality, and that's happening every day in Nicaragua. No, so it was it's there. But Joya, but I do want to say, I've gone through this really difficult experience, but and the cruel treatment that I was subjected was really with the intention of punishing me, especially as a woman, as a feminist, to kind of break my spirit, to be silent, and to stop me from stop my activism and I feel like my will to transform the world. And there was a very particular viciousness around that, and it was made very clear in the interrogations. But I want to say that I've come out of that experience, I think, with totally the opposite, with a profound sense of gratitude and appreciation and love from also with just so much appreciation for the solidarity and the generosity of so many people around the world. For me, also when I was released, I was able to see also all of the expressions worldwide of women, women's networks around the world who were demanding that we be liberated, and that did all sorts of amazing things, you know, in solidarity of for those of us who are in jail. And so I feel like they really, they were really not able, no, to achieve their goal, which is to break my spirit and to break my hope. And I feel like they achieved the contrary. I decided at some point while I was in prison that I was going to, that this experience was going to be like my forced spiritual retreat, that I was going to take advantage also of that, of this terrible experience to reflect, to learn, and to think about also the things that I wanted to do differently in life, but to come with some lessons. And I did try to also include that in the story that I thought for my son, that I, the things that I wanted him to learn about life and that I wanted to share. I've really learned a lot from this difficult experience.
Your resiliency illuminates off your skin, your spirit. I don't know if you remember the very first time I spoke with you at the conference. It was before my workshop, and I didn't know anybody. The conference had started. I had to fly in from the East Coast, so it had started hours earlier. And so I got there, I sat down at a table, and I was at a table next to yours, the round table, 10 people at a table. And we kind of turned toward each other. I introduced myself. You introduced yourself. And we talked. And then you told me that you had been held in a Nicaraguan prison for 660 days. 606 days. I don't know if you remember, I stopped talking.
Yes.
I just stared at you.
I remember.
You remember? I just stopped talking. I just stared at you. Part of me wanted to hug you like you were my little girl, and you know you're not that young, but I just wanted to hug you. And another part was, God has never asked me to do that. I have never been challenged with that, to stand for what I believe in a prison. And I was just, I don't think I asked you another question. I don't think I said another thing. I just thought, she's amazing, because I'm not quite sure what my physical or psychological response would be to that. I mean, I'm upset when I can't find Starbucks. So I commend you. And I know that there are women like you. My hero is Harriet Tubman, who freed everybody she could reach, who wanted to come with her. And she did it in the dark with a gun and a lantern, and sometimes no lantern. And I wonder if that could be me. But I am honored to have known you. But here's my next question. I read through your biography. I learned something I hadn't heard before. You're a Fulbright scholar?
Yeah, I am.
How did you become a Fulbright scholar? You're amazing.
I applied for the Fulbright when I was in Nicaragua, and I was able to obtain that Fulbright, and that was my first experience here in the United States and studying the United States in 2003. I am.
Yeah. You are doing it in environmental justice.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Right. That's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's, and you mentioned
that's
that
how
earlier.
My activism began. Environmental justice and looking really at those interconnections and intersectionality of also that relation between gender, poverty, environmental injustice in my home country. And that really fueled my work and my activism for social justice in Nicaragua and worldwide, and learned so much from so many movements around the world too.
Okay. So what's next for you?
Well, now I'm leading a new initiative. Like I said, I feel like this experience has opened up also new opportunities and has strengthened my commitment. I'm now the executive director of a new initiative that's in incubation that wants to support other women political leaders thrive, especially in the global South, and women who are coming from the most marginalized communities. I want to support to generate those possibilities, generate structures and support so that they can gain political power. And so I'm now involved in that. Personally, for me, healing is you know part of what I am. That's an ongoing process, and I must say it'll. I think it'll take some time, but I'm in my own healing process. But very much involved in that, in helping other women overcome the challenges that around the world we are facing to be able to gain political power and to be able to transform our communities, our world, and to move forward agendas in favor of women and our society. So raising a lot of awareness around that and trying to galvanize support for women political leaders, raising awareness on the need for support in terms of the violence that women are facing when they get involved, especially if you're a woman that's an indigenous woman, if you're a Black woman, or you're a woman coming from an LGBTQ community, and how that violence is heightened. Or if you are at the forefront in your own country fighting for opening those spaces for democracy. So I'm involved in that, but I'm also part of my learnings, I think, in jail was to bring to my life a bit more balance, to be able to also take care of myself and my family. So wanting to have more balance in my life. And I think that's a learning that's important for all who are in activism, you know, around the world or here in the U.S., to be able to also balance that. I'm also trying to see how I can write the story for my son about what I learned and how I resisted, how important it is to to think about those strategies of resistance and teaching him a lot about gratitude. If there's something that I learned, you know, in jail is that there was always something every day that I could be grateful for. And I've tried to incorporate that in my life as I was released. And so every night when we before we go to sleep, we try to make a list and we ask ourselves, so what are we grateful for today? And try to, you know, incorporate that practice in our life. And I think that's really important. And so that's part of what I want to write more about my own experience. And maybe it can be useful for other women. And also continue to work with other women who have faced what I have faced too. So
I hope you write a book.
Yeah. You know,
I hope you write a book.
Well, I was also in jail. I realized how my interest in writing more about the difficulties of balancing activism, especially political activism and being a mother. And dealing with guilt, which is something that was hard for me, and that my mom, while I was in jail, really helped me overcome, you know, the guilt that I was feeling. When one of the visits, she said, I was crying, say, you know, I've missed his birthday. I'm not coming out. I feel like this is going for a long time. And I remember that she said, you know, my sweet daughter, but don't feel that guilt. Don't feel that guilt, because all the things that you do is because you are also doing it for him, you know, for him to have a a better yes. world to live in. And that's how my story began. And trying to explain to my son why I was involved in what I was involved in, but trying to use animals in the story. And that in part, you know, I was taken because I was dreaming to give him a better world, you know, a better Nicaragua. And so she really helped me with dealing with the guilt. So I want to, yes, I would like to write more about that, how difficult it is and how other, I would love to be able to interview other women and learn, you know.
Well, you have the resource. There were 50 women in that room when we were in. And I also want to say to the audience that that room was filled with women, not just Su Yin, who had been arrested and tortured in their countries, but these women were from Asia and from South America who were there, who have maybe not as dramatic a story, but dramatic stories. One, there were a couple of people there who could not be photographed because their governments are still looking for them. And so it was
or their
thrilling.
Families are threatened
or their families are threatened.
We're dealing yes. with that guilt and those dilemmas,
yes.
which
yes.
is
yes.
something that I deal with too. You know, I have family and I remember that in that forum, you know, one of the young ladies were saying, I feel guilt. I feel guilt for my family.
Because she got out and her family didn't. Her story was tremendous. And I want to share her story really quickly here as we come to a close here. She got out of her country and her mother and her sister didn't. And it's an Islamic country. And her mother and sister sometimes go without food because they need a man to escort them to the marketplace. And if they can't get a man to take them, stay with them, and get them back home, they don't eat. She can't send things. She was filled and riddled to tears in the middle of my workshop, to tears about her guilt. Her survivor's guilt, and the Open Society Foundation is helping her get in touch with her family, hopefully get her family out of there. But she felt so much guilt, she wanted to go back to be with her mother and her sister. You know, one of the things, and I want you to address this as we close out here, Su Yin, we all face something in our lives. And you said something a moment ago, you said, how I resist it. It is resistance that's going to change the world. It is resistance. And a lot of times as Americans, we don't want to resist for fear of losing our income. We don't want to resist for fear of losing our status. You resisted when there was a fear of, when there was a threat to your life. So if you were to advise people, all the women in the world, as you're trying to do on resistance, what would you say?
Well, I think that that resistance is accompanied by also community. What makes you strong and more able, I think, to resist is to form community also in that process. I feel like I resisted this jail time because although I was alone in that cell, to be honest, Joya, I was never, you know, never felt alone. I never felt lonely because I knew that there were so many people from my community, women's community, my family, people who didn't know me, but that I had somehow weaved this community of people struggling for justice around the world that were also pressuring and demanding. And I think that's really important to understand as we think about resistance. And then just the power of solidarity and generosity of others, and how that is a source of strength. And if I did learn something, was that we as humans really are incredibly strong in the most difficult circumstances. And that there's always, you know, always lots of good that can come out of very difficult experiences. I think part of what helped me resist and survive was trying to tap into the most positive of, you know, in my life, the thoughts, reminding me constantly that this was like a parenthesis in my life, and that this was not my life. What was the pain that I was experiencing in that time? That was just part of my life, that there was just much more to come. And to be able to think about, you know, resisting also one day at a time, that really, really helped me. The one day at a time, being very flexible and resistant, like the bamboo. I really reminded myself, you know, of the strength and the flexibility of the bamboo, and how in life things are really uncertain. Very uncertain. That's what's really, you know, a constant in life. And that in the measure that we learn how to adapt and be flexible, we are able to resist much more, like the bamboo tree, to those, to that uncertainty, and really tapping into the love. You know, I really learned that love, the love of my family, the love of people, can really achieve it all and can heal it all. So those, I think, are some of the lessons. No, and I really came out of that experience thinking that it's just really worthwhile to make the effort to try. And to keep on dreaming and doing whatever we can to change the world, but also being generous with ourselves, Joya, as you were, you know, I think really pointed out in that convening, in that forum, which is also to be forgiving of ourselves when we're not able, you know, forgiving of ourselves when we are not able to see all the changes or cannot do. I've as I was released, I'm really working a lot on pausing when I don't, you know, when I'm tired. I'm pausing when I am in doubt, and recharging, and that really is also, I think, a practice of trying to be forgiving and understanding of oneself. And that is resisting. And there are many forms of resisting. Like in jail, my form of resistance was also to dance sometimes, to sing, to be in solidarity with others, to, for example, try to share medicine with others when I heard that someone was missing. So yeah, there's just so many forms of resistance. And for me, one of the main, and I hope that it's for many others, is when we have these very difficult experiences, to resist the temptation of filling our hearts with that hate, and with and to become, you know, those who have hurt us. That has been very important, and I feel like
that is important. That is important, to resist becoming hateful.
Yes, to resist
and angry.
Becoming hateful and angry, and to do things out of that, and gratitude. I think part of the resistance is learning to be grateful, you know, every day. And like I said, I've learned that every day there's something that we can be grateful for. I came out of this experience when you're deprived of absolutely everything. I've come out like with this gratitude of having to see the sun, to be able to breathe, to have a cup of coffee, to be able to eat at a time that you can eat.
Yeah.
That's, there's a new appreciation for life in that sense.
That's beautiful. You know, that piece of gratitude, that's your superpower. that's everybody's superpower, to be grateful that it's raining. When I finish this, I have to go somewhere and I have to walk and it's pouring rain. So instead of being frightened of it, I'm just going to enjoy it and to be grateful. And the piece about the pause, I call it sacred rest. I think I talked about it in the workshop.
Yes.
Where you have to find a time that you stop. You have to rejuvenate. You have to allow the cells of your body and the tendons around your muscles to heal and to heal your soul. And it doesn't mean you're not tenacious enough to stay in the resistance. It doesn't mean that you're a poor mother or a poor worker or a poor activist. It means you recognize the physical body, the structure of your brain needs to stop. And that is it. Suyin, thank you so very much for being here. This has been an exhilarating, encouraging, enlightening, and wonderful conversation. It's so nice to talk with you again.
Thank you, Joya. I've learned so much in the little time that I have met you, but your conversation was so impactful for me, and it's stayed with me in the journey of healing. After meeting you and after this process of healing and after being released. So I really thank you. And yes, I'm so grateful that the universe has allowed me to meet people like you and continues to allow me to meet just so courageous women around the world. That is inspiring. And that's the other thing I want to say. In order to resist, to surround yourselves of other courageous and wonderful women, because that gives us strength.
Thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. I appreciate you being here. This is another edition of Unshackled Leadership, A Lantern for Black Women, and this clearly was a lantern conversation. I'm Joya Jefferson Nuri. I hope you join us again. Peace and blessings. I want to thank you for joining us for another episode of Unshackled Leadership, A Lantern for Black Women. I want to thank the people who make this all possible, beginning with our senior producer, India Tisdale of It Takes Pure Effort Consulting. And our program editor is Grammy Award nominated singer and obviously extraordinary editor, Carolyn Malachi. Dominica Eldridge of Unique Creatives created our phenomenal artwork. And Hotham of HothamMusic.com created the theme song that you listen to every single show. Again, thank you for joining us, and I hope that you will be here for our next episode. Peace and blessings.